Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. My name is Keith Pannell, and in the studio with me today is sometime co-host Russ Chianelli. And today we're going to be talking to an author, a prolific author, who concentrates on things that I can put under the general title of nature's medicines. And his name is Stephen Foster. Are you there, Stephen Foster?
I'm here.
Jolly good. Well, welcome to Science Studio. Let's start out by you telling us about your formative years, right? Where did you get into this interest in nature's medicine and the prolific book writing that you've got into?
Well, I grew up in a small town on the coast of Maine, and my family was the new kids on the block, so to speak. My dad's lived in the same house since 1939, and the neighbors across the street had lived there since the 1820s when the house was built. So there was a strong sense of place and continuity and knowing the natural world around us in that neighborhood. And a neighbor across the street, Barbara Garso, organized a junior Audubon club for some of the kids in the neighborhood. And that really sparked my interest as a 7 or 8 year old in the natural world.
And so how did you figure out that these plants might have medicinal uses?
Well, between my junior and senior year of high school, I was walking in the woods with a friend, and a plant called Trillium was blooming, and I saw this plant and said, "Oh, I wonder what this plant is." And she said, "My grandfather calls it Stinking Benjamin and says it's used as an aid in childbirth." And at that moment I said, "Oh, I want to learn the names and uses of all the plants," not knowing that that would turn into a lifelong pursuit now in its 42nd year.
Well, in fact, then tell us, why has Stinking Benjamin got such an interesting name?
Well, the flowers have a bit of a fetid smell to attract flies.
Yeah, but come on, where does Ben come into this? Who's this Benjamin?
It doesn't have anything to do with the formulation of the 13 colonies, did it?
Who knows?
Oh, so that's still a mystery that's to be solved.
Yes.
It was attractive, presumably, pretty flowers?
Beautiful flowers, yes. Beautiful maroon flowers. It's related to lilies, so it's a very attractive wildflower, yes.
And do you think that in the days when you discovered it and your friend's grandfather said it was used for facilitating childbirth, were there still people around when you were a young boy that actually used that in any form or other?
I don't know at that particular point in time, but a few months later, I ended up working at the Sabbath-day Lake Maine Shaker community, which has the oldest herb business in the U.S., dating to 1799. And basically, everything I've done since 1974 started with that experience at the Shaker community, learning about cultivating herbs, uses of herbs, historical uses of medicinal plants, commercial herb production, and so forth. And so that has taken me to 6 continents, studying traditional uses of medicinal plants, photographing medicinal plants, writing about medicinal plants.
Well, let's just get into then the medical aspect of this. Several directions that we could go, but would you say that in North America and Western Europe, we have really almost forgotten how to use natural plants for medicinal purposes?
Well, not so much in Europe, but certainly in the United States. And if we look at the history of the development of medicines in the U.S., really from the colonial period up until about the 1890s, most of the materia medica, the articles available in pharmacies and prescribed by physicians were medicinal plants. And then in the 1890s, a lab at the Bayer Company in Germany looking to make salicylic acid, which was used as a anti-inflammatory, a pain medicine, an analgesic. They were looking to make it more bioavailable and to buffer it so it didn't have an irritating effect on the digestive system. So they added an acetyl chain to the salicylic acid molecule and created acetylsalicylic acid, which we now know as aspirin. And that moment in the 1890s ushered in an era of synthetic drugs, which completely, for the most part, took over medicinal plants in the American pharmaceutical trade by the 1930s or 40s. Now, at the same time, phytomedicine in Europe was beginning to develop a scientific foundation. So German scientists were looking for mechanisms of action of medicinal plants and trying to determine the pharmacology and develop large-scale clinical experience, which came in the form mostly of case reports for physicians. So take something like echinacea, for example, which has almost become a household word. When you see it used on a TV sitcom, you know that it's entered the mainstream. But around the turn of the 19th and 20th century, echinacea was the single most widely prescribed American medicinal plant by physicians in the U.S.
That's what you've got a book on this, and you call it Nature's Immune Enhancer. Is that correct?
Yes.
What does that mean?
The title is the publisher's and not mine.
listener, beware. Reader, beware.
The history, botany, and medicinal uses of the purple coneflowers. But today, echinacea is perceived as a short-term stimulant for the immune system and perceived to be useful for preventing or shortening the duration of upper respiratory tract infections.
When you say that, you know, there are some of us that get a little nervous. I know there was something called St. John's Wort, and maybe, well, I'm sure you know everything about St. John's Wort. I know nothing other than you can go to your local pharmacy and go to the shelf where you can just pick and choose without having a prescription from an MD, and you'll pick up many, many samples of additives, and they say contains or is, you know, primary ingredient St. John's Wort, and then tests have shown that at least a certain high percentage of those don't have any St. John's Wort in them. Is this of concern to you? Because, you know, clearly you've got the knowledge. You have researched this and you know that there are good supplements that we could be using, but no one seems to be able to control what's put out there under the name of supplements.
That is the general perception. And the fact is that there are over 80 regulations promulgated by FDA on dietary supplement regulations. But yes, the perception is there that dietary supplements are quote-unquote unregulated, and as a consumer, you don't know what you're getting. Currently, FDA has instituted what's called current good manufacturing practices, in which manufacturers have to basically create a paper trail of the exact origin and the identity and the scientific rationale for the identity of a particular ingredient. But that said, there's a tremendous amount of variation in product quality, product ID, and one of the things I do is work with a nonprofit in Austin, the American Botanical Council, and we basically serve as a bridge between the scientific literature on medicinal plants and popular understanding. And I'm working on a botanical adult rinse program, which is supported by many organizations worldwide that have something to do with analytical chemistry or regulation or setting standards for medicinal plant ingredients.
So, I mean, this is going to be like the good housekeeping seal of approval, right? That, I mean, if you don't have that approval, like you can go and get organic foods, but now it has to be certified by some organization. Is this what you see down the line to make sure that the public is getting the best use out of all these wonderful plants?
Well, there are various certification seals already in use, but as an example, the United States Pharmacopeia, which defines drugs in the United States, defines the identity and the quality of prescription drugs, over-the-counter drugs, and now dietary supplements, they have a certification seal program where they show that a particular product or ingredient in a product has been verified according to the standards set by the United States Pharmacopeia.
So in general, though, you're happy then with the current state of affairs? And you see it's only going to get better?
I'm not.
All right.
Even myself, with nuanced knowledge on medicinal plants, I can go into a health food store and not have a clue what particular brand to buy or what particular product. It's a very difficult situation for consumers. And let me use another example, saw palmetto, which is primarily used for benign prostatic hyperplasia, which BPH, a benign enlargement of the prostate, which is really not self-diagnosable or self-treatable. So, you know, you really have to have a physician diagnose it. There's a book that was published in 1699, the Journal of Jonathan Dickinson. He was a shipwrecked Quaker off the coast of Florida, and he describes the Indians who captured his group of castaways, the Indians giving them saw palmetto berries to eat. And because of the flavor, they couldn't eat the berries. And he described the flavor as likened to rotten cheese steeped in tobacco juice, which is to say saw palmetto has a very distinctive flavor and fragrance.
It sounds as good as stinking Benjamin.
So if you have a saw palmetto extract or product that has no flavor or fragrance, I'm going to be suspect of it.
Okay. You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell, here with Russ Chianelli. And our guest today is Stephen Foster, an author of many books on nature's medicine, different plants that have different ingredients that really should be taken seriously and used under control as supplements. We'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. David Niesel.
And I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog. Next time you're clearing your ceiling corners of spider webs, just think, wow, they're trying to grow an organ on that.
Well, not actual spider webs, but synthetic versions of them. Researchers are genetically engineering fibers of spideroin, a protein that makes up the bulk of spider silk.
Spideroin may be the answer to the challenge of finding a compatible scaffold to grow a human heart. Finding a viable scaffold is among the greatest challenges in the cutting-edge field of organ growing.
A matrix for the human heart must have mechanical and elastic properties similar to the heart, be biocompatible, and allow electrical properties essential to the proper functioning of the heart.
Scientists created two forms of synthetic spideroin and found the silk from these two proteins have high biocompatibility. The next step was to show that cardiac cells grown on the spider silk matrix achieve coordinated electrical activity that orchestrates the pumping actions of the heart.
They spun blends of spideroin to form matrices on glass discs. They then applied mouse cardiac cells to the scaffold sitting in a growth media and compared how well the cells adhered to the silk against other natural protein matrices. This is crucial because cells that don't attach die.
One formulation of the spider silk bound 90% as many cells as the control matrix. And left to grow for 3 days, the cells formed a uniform layer across the matrix and began to show electrical activity and coordinated movements of contraction.
A lot more testing is ahead, but so far it's encouraging. Spider silk could be the next wonder material, whether it's body armor, better bandages, or in this case, a working heart.
We are Drs. David Niesel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Russ Chianelli, and we're talking today on Science Studio to Stephen Foster. He's an author of many, many books on what he calls, and I like this, nature's medicines. And these are different plants that give rise to ingredients that will be very good supplements for many of us, if only we knew where to get them and get them reliably.
We have a store here, Natural Solutions. Many of the people believe strongly in the use of these plants and medicines to cure them. And you have something called Stephen Foster Group, Inc., imagery and information on medicinal plants and herbs since 1974. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. I started at the Shaker community at Sabbath Day Lake, Maine in 1974. And basically, everything I do now, I started there working on herbs, as well as photography. There were world-famous photographers coming through there all the time. Part of my job was to shadow them while they were in the community or the museum. So that's how I acquired photographic skills. But basically, I've been studying and writing about medicinal plants long before this was a popular subject. For example, about 1980, the herb market in the U.S. was only about $250 million a year in annual sales at the retail level. Now it is something over $5 billion. So over the years, I've done a lot of writing projects, technical writing projects related to sourcing of medicinal plant materials from around the world, developing commercial supplies, looking at adulterant problems, utilizing the historical literature to find new information that is relevant for today. For example, in the 1980s, I worked a lot on the plant group Echinacea, and I discovered an obscure little article in a 1910 pharmacy journal that noted that there was an adulterant to echinacea root on the market that year, in the fall of 1909. And at the time, I was collecting herbarium specimens, pressed plant specimens of echinacea species, for a research group at the University of Munich. And I put in a specimen of this plant called wild quinine or Missouri snake root, Parthenium integrifolium, and asked if it was showing up on the world market or in the German market at that time, because these scientists were working on the chemistry of echinacea. And they had just published two studies on four new sesquiterpenes from Echinacea purpurea root. And they looked at the Parthenium specimen and discovered that, in fact, they had published on new sesquiterpenes from Parthenium integrifolium, not Echinacea purpurea at all. So this threw basically, the echinacea research prior to 1986 into a tizzy.
So, I mean, the principle there, Stephen, is maybe that the plants look very similar or what? I mean, was this just total fraud or just a mistake because the plants look similar? I mean, give us a bit of an inkling as to how something like that can be perpetrated.
The plants themselves did not look similar, but the root, when it was cut and sifted, the form it sold on the wholesale market, looked very similar.
I see.
And so the problem had persisted for so many decades that most herb companies who sold Echinacea purpurea root actually had a Parthenium integrifolium root as the standard of identity.
Well, but did it make
Echinacea
any difference?
Purpurea.
Did the people who took this supplement just, they're quite happy with this one or that one? As long as it was an ugly-looking root, they felt good about it.
Well, placebo effect is 30% effective.
Is that true? That, I mean, 30%, that's pretty good. That's intriguing.
Anyway, this stimulated scientific research on Echinacea, both in Europe and the United States, and looking at all 9 species of Echinacea and their chemistry. So as the result of this historical mistake, we have a much better understanding of the chemistry of Echinacea today.
That leads really to a big general sort of interest that people like Russ and I, we're both chemists, and we know all sorts of people who spend a lifetime, a career, finding plants in exotic locations and then finding all the various components, all the different chemicals that are there, and then testing all the chemicals for a particular therapeutic usage. Do you think that's one of the great assets of knowing all about plants, or do you believe that the plant itself or the total extract is more efficient than just the particular active ingredient that chemists or biologists will say is the really important part?
Well, I think it's difficult to generalize that one has to look at each plant species or even each plant part on an individual basis to answer that question. So for something like, well, let's go back to Echinacea just for a moment. The first active component that appeared in the literature was a glycoside called echinacoside, published in a paper in the mid-1950s that attributed weak antibacterial activity to it. So up until late 1970s, extracts that were being manufactured in Europe were calibrated to echinacoside content, even though it probably had no relationship to the expected pharmacological activity. Dr. Rudolf Bauer, then at the University of Munich, speaking at a conference on Echinacea, this was about 20 years ago, because echinacoside did not occur in all Echinacea species and occurred, broadly speaking, it's a phenolic compound. So people started making extracts out of Echinacea species that were more common that did not contain this compound. So they simply calibrated the extract to total phenolics. And Dr. Rudy Bauer asked, what is the relationship of total phenolics in an Echinacea extract to its biological activity? Or to the quality of the product, responded with looking at total phenolics in Echinacea products is like basing your decision to purchase an automobile on its iron content. The compound has to be relative. You mentioned St. John's wort. Back in the 1990s, one could look at the emerging literature at that point and ask the question, what is the active constituent of the weak? Because it would be hyperforin or hypericide or other compounds to which biological activity was attributed weak to weak. Now, there was a research group in the UK that earlier this year published results of a study on what they thought might be an antibacterial mixture that came out of a medieval manuscript. And what they found when they mixed all these strange ingredients together, that it was antibacterial if all of the components were in the mixture, but if you remove one of the components, it no longer had an antibacterial effect against Staphylococcus aureus or E. coli.
So that's sort of an interesting result. I mean, and this complementarity of different ingredients. I mean, it's a new form of medicine. Rather than having just one medicine for a particular clinical condition, you take a couple. You take this, you know, potpourri of medications. Look, we don't have a lot of time left, but I've got a sort of question here. Are these plants all natural, or are there now organizations, farms that grow echinacea and St. John's wort, and you can go and see them in their full glory, or do you have to hunt them in forests and glens?
It really depends, again, on the particular plant. Echinacea purpurea, which is the common echinacea that people grow as a garden perennial, the entire world's supply is cultivated. If you look at the 150 or so species of plants that are used in phytomedicine in Europe, still 80% of the supply is wild harvested, mostly in Eastern Europe.
Yeah, are there any examples where you can look back in history and understand how the people figured this out? Or is that too difficult? I mean, all of a sudden you're using this plant and it works 1,000 years ago.
Well, there's various approaches to attempting to understand that. If you look at the straight ethnobotanical literature, it basically says that primitive man arbitrarily tasted this plant or another, and if it didn't kill him, then maybe it was edible or maybe it had a medicinal effect. I think that we have to understand cultures in a totally different context of ways of thinking. And so in what we call quote-unquote primitive societies, like in Amazonia, for example, a shaman is more likely to come up with an idea for a medicinal use from a dream.
And then send some hapless youth out to test it, right?
Right.
There's got to be an experiment in there. Look, we've run out of time, Stephen, but I got one last question. Your own personal lifestyle, how many of these just different supplements and herbs do you take on a regular basis?
Well, my two favorite herbs are chocolate and coffee.
You're right in line with Russell and I. It's been a lot of fun, Stephen Foster, author of many, many books on all sorts of different plants.
Yeah, it's a fascinating thing, and I'm sure that we're going to be talking to you more, and we'd like to thank Norma Martinez, our producer.
Indeed we would. And we'd like to thank you, the listener, for being there. Without you, there's no program. We'll be back next week with another Science Studio. Goodbye.
Thank you.